calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday, the first hour of our program, as always. Years and years of habit. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Well, this time I'm broadcasting live from Washington, D.C., from the from the Families USA Conference. And so Bernie and I are sitting here across the table from each other. Hey, Bernie.
And we haven't been together for a couple of years. We did the last show, I think, in your home in Montpelier.
Yeah, that was right. That
been
was
a few years.
3 years ago, it has been a while. But it's great to see you. It's great to
good
be
to
here
be
with
you, Tom.
Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie will be taking your calls at 1-866-440-8466 right after the first break. And also, if you want to drop into our live chat room, I'm there as well. TomHartman.com. Click live chat. Bernie, what's up?
Well, there's a lot that's going on, Tom. I think the Democrats are moving forward in a lot of very good ways. Nancy Pelosi's 100 hours effort, I think, is paying off in showing the American people what could happen if you begin to focus on the real issues facing our citizens rather than just right-wing wedge issues that the Republicans have pushed onto the agenda over the last many years. We are in the Senate right now dealing with the minimum wage. The good news is that I believe shortly a $7.25 an hour minimum wage increase will be passed. Right now, in an outrageous way, it is $5.15. The Republicans have not raised it in 10 years.
Aren't they trying to blow that up in the Senate right now?
Well, that's what I'm saying. They are going to try. They're trying to stop it. They will not be successful. So what people understand is that in the House, you just need 50% plus one of the votes, and the Democrats have it. In the Senate, you need 60% of the votes to stop debate. So the Republicans, in typical fashion, are trying to detour it. They're trying to bring forth all kinds of amendments. But I think at the end of the day, we will have a $7.25 an hour minimum wage. Now, what I would like to see is simply a clean minimum wage bill. The low-income workers of this country have been waiting years for that. They should get it and get it as soon as possible. Unfortunately, what the Republicans are doing is delaying the action so that eventually there will be a tax break that goes to businesses. My guess it'll be somewhere around $8 billion, and that's what will happen, but the minimum wage will raise. I would prefer and will vote for a straight minimum wage. Democrats have made some progress on ethics reform. Senate passed probably the strongest ethics reform since Watergate, and that's important. But what is more important is that we swing to campaign finance reform and move, in my view, to public funding of elections, because what present trends, Tom, are about is these guys who have huge sums of money are just pouring it into the political process. And you're seeing candidates from both sides of the aisle, you're seeing progressives, conservatives spending more and more time simply hustling money. And that's not what American democracy is about. That's the bad news. The good news, and I don't know if you've talked about it much on the show, is that in states like Maine, Arizona, Connecticut, New Jersey, there is a movement to what they call clean elections. And that is public funding of elections. I think that's the direction that states should go, and I think that's the direction the United States government should go. If we don't move in that direction, what you're going to continue to see is huge pressure being placed on the House and the Senate to represent the interest of big money interests rather than the needs of the middle class. During the ethics debate, I passed a modest amendment, but it's an amendment that makes a strong point, that I wanted to track how big money interests made campaign contributions for some of the most important pieces of legislation that passed in the last couple of years. Prescription drug, Medicare, how much did the drug companies put into the political process? Mm-hmm. The bankruptcy bill, how much did they put in? The Central American Free Trade Agreement and so forth and so on.
Right.
So tracking the role that big money plays is enormous. We need to move to public funding. I was at a hearing a couple of weeks ago, very interesting hearing on stem cell research. And I'll tell you, Tom, what was interesting about it is not just hearing from major scientists about what stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, can do in beginning to address some of the most serious illnesses facing the American people, facing millions of people. What was also interesting is to see the defensiveness of the right wingers who, when faced with real science, they had nothing to say.
What are they holding up, garlic?
I mean, the idea of arguing that cells that would otherwise be thrown into a garbage can cannot be used for research into Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and spinal cord injury. I mean, it is so absurd.
It is.
That they almost didn't make the case.
Yeah.
And you really see what happens. What was interesting to me is the first time I was in a hearing where you see right-wing extremism faced with modern science, and right-wing extremism had very little to say. Obviously, the issue of the day, and boy, and the Senate moves quite slowly. What people tell you is true.
Yeah.
Senate moves very slowly.
The deliberative body.
Yeah. Well, maybe, maybe not. It's slow, I would say. Yeah. Is the war in Iraq?
Yeah.
And clearly, what we have is a president who is not only continuing to make from beginning to today horrendous policy decisions, from getting us in the war, misleading us into the war, to not being prepared for the war, to not knowing us how to get out of the war. But what you're seeing now, and I think even Republicans are beginning to see an arrogance, a guy who says, it is my way or the highway.
Yeah.
And I love bipartisan super, says the president. I love coming together, but of course we're going to do it my way. You can work with me. That's great.
As long as you do it my way.
As long as you do it my way. Oh, the Congress has a different opinion. I see. The American people have a different opinion on Iraq. My generals have a different opinion on Iraq. The Iraq Study Group has a different opinion. The Iraqi people have a different opinion. No fear. We'll do it my way. That's okay.
Yeah.
So what we will be seeing, this is what's going on in terms of Iraq. Number one, and I think this is a good start, you're going to see a bipartisan resolution, I think, coming to the floor next week. How many Republicans will be on board? We don't know. Certainly Chuck Hagel will be there. Olympia Snowe will be there. How many others? A couple of competing resolutions. But you're going to have a number of Republicans joining virtually every Democrat, myself as an independent, maybe with the exception of Senator Lieberman, saying that this escalation of the war is a very, very bad idea. Okay, now what's the importance of that? Is this binding? No. What's the importance? The importance about having a bipartisan resolution, hopefully with 60 senators, will, I think, show the American people how isolated the president is.
You know, at a certain level, one of the main things that you and I both preach, I mean, you do it on this program every week and continually in your life, and I do it 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, is that individual citizens need to get active and need to have their voices be heard in Washington, D.C. In a way, this non-binding resolution is the Senate's version of doing that same thing, of standing up and speaking out. I can't pass a law, but I can stand up and speak out. The Senate, ultimately, hopefully, will pass a law, but this is a beginning point.
This is a beginning. And here's the important point to be made. Almost all of the Democrats, more or less, are against the escalation. A lot of Republicans are nervous about it because they're smart enough to understand that Bush has been wrong, wrong, and wrong. And he's going back to the same advisors who have been consistently wrong. They have doubts about it. These guys are not dummies. But the other thing that they are worried about is they're worried about the future of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Bush is not going to run for re-election. He's finished in 2 years. These guys do not want to be finished in 2 years. So what you're going to see, and this is where, to pick up on your point, people can play a long-term role, a very important role. Which Republicans are coming up in 2 years? Make sure that you talk to them. Make sure that they know your views on Iraq. Put pressure on them and on all Republicans and on all members of the House and the Senate. So now, beyond this non-binding resolution, there's a lot of work being done by people, and I'm working with Senator Kennedy, Senator Dodd, Senator Feingold, and that is what we're looking at are two things. Number one, reasserting the constitutional authority of the United States Congress as the body that makes war or not, demanding that the president come back to Congress and say, the original reason that I went to war is no longer relevant. I was wrong then, of course, there were no weapons of mass destruction. Iraq was not allied with Al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera. But the whole reason for the escalation of the war has nothing to do with the original authorization given to the president. That is pretty clear. We're not in a civil war there. The president can make his case, but he should go back for new authorization. Number two, the budget authority rests with the Congress. And what I hope and what I will be working on is for Congress to assert its budget authority in A, not funding the escalation, and B, putting together a budget which provides our troops with all the support that they need as we bring them home, as soon as possible.
So they're not hurt on the back end
exactly.
Either. Yeah. 16 minutes past the hour, we'll be taking your calls. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment with Senator Bernie Sanders here, 866-440-THOM, our telephone number. We'll be right back.
Never say thank you to those who love many. Never say thank you to those who still have fair. Hallelujah, the meek shall inherit. Never say thank you to all you people out there.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. And occasionally from Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment, 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, Kurt in Stovermont. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello there.
Hey, Kurt.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Kurt?
Oh, very glad that you're down there, Bernie, along with a whole lot of other Vermonters. Hope it's a little warmer. They were freezing today up here. Bernie, I had a question about...
Kurt, you'd be amazed it's even cold in Washington, D.C. today.
Right on. Hey, I had questions about President Bush and Congress's role as far as conducting some investigations that
yes.
haven't happened prior to this time, and wondering what investigations we can look forward to and how soon they'll start.
They're starting already, Kurt, and there are going to be a whole lot of investigations both in the House and in the Senate. I think you're going to see investigations in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Bush's abuse of constitutional rights, his attack on constitutional rights. I think you're going to see it there. I think you're going to see in the committees that deal with defense spending a hard look at the no-bid contracts the companies like Halliburton get. I think you're going to see investigations regarding what Bush knew and when he knew it in terms of getting us into the war in Iraq in the first place. So I think you're going to see many investigations about how we got into the war, the conduct of the war, Bush's attacks on civil liberties, the kinds of influence that big money had in passing, getting the Bush administration to support a disastrous energy bill, so forth and so on. I think after 6 years of Congress acting as a rubber stamp for the White House, you're going to see some serious investigations.
Thank goodness. Ken in Long Beach, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Oh, yes. Good to talk to you guys. Listening to you here on Sirius Radio. I was just wondering, you know, a lot of people get hung up on the word socialist a lot. You know, you're talking about framing the debate, you know, socialized medicine and stuff, especially, I don't know if you heard Michael Savage last night. He was really ragging on you, Bernie. You know, he said your mother should have aborted you, and you were, I guess you're from the same neck of the woods that he is, right? You're from originally from New York. And but anyway, the word socialist, you know, gets people all hung up, you know. I don't know about American industry. It seems like a lot of them are, you know, going for the, single-payer medical care, too.
Right, right.
So,
Well, I guess if I'm attacked by Michael Savage, I must be doing something right.
But actually, you guys agree on a lot of stuff, you know, because free trade, you're terrific on. I mean, he's a socialist, too, on free trade. He agrees with you 100% about American jobs. He's pretty good, you know, and all that stuff.
Okay. Well, but here's the point, and I'm glad you asked that question. When we talk about democratic socialism, what listeners should understand, that over the years, in Europe, in Scandinavia, you have had one democratic socialist government after the other. And many of the advances made by labor governments, social democratic governments, democratic socialist governments in Europe and Scandinavia have been pretty profound. Unfortunately, we don't hear too much about some of the successes that they've had. I mean, if you look at a country like Finland, you look at a country like Denmark, which over the years has had a social democratic or labor governments, what you find is that childhood poverty virtually doesn't exist at all. You find that every person has health care as a right of citizenship. You find that education is of high quality. College education is virtually free. You find that workers have stronger unemployment benefits. You find that when people have families have babies, moms and dads can get time off for work with pay. You find that compared to the vacation time that exists in the United States of America, where many workers are lucky to get 1 week, 2 weeks a year, in many of the European countries, people are getting 4, 5, 6 weeks a year of paid vacation. If you take a look at some of the accomplishments of these countries, they're pretty good. Are they? Do they have economic problems? Sure they do. But I think we should focus on some of their advances and see how we can transform those ideas in America so that we can protect the needs of the middle class in terms of health care for all people, educational opportunity for all people, doing a better job in protecting our environment, protecting our kids, our women in a way that in many ways we're not doing.
Gary in New York City, we have just a minute before we have to take a break here. Gary, quick question.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. All right, the Constitution does not say every individual in the United States or every citizen has or is assured the right of habeas corpus. It doesn't say that. It simply says the right of habeas corpus shall be suspended. What are you going to do about Alberto Gonzalez saying this? I mean, this seems to be this idea. It's basically they want to take their foreign policy, which is, you know, anybody raises their head, we just kill you, okay? And they want to take that foreign policy attitude. They want to bring it back to the United States. You make a stink, we just arrest you and throw you in jail, and then we don't even tell you why, and you rot.
Well, I think as I have said, Gary, in many instances, this president and his administration clearly do not understand what the Constitution is about. What I think you are going to see, I hope you will see, on the Judiciary Committee and other committees, is a hard look at everything this president has done to deny us our constitutional rights and pass legislation to restore those rights.
Well said. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
Yes, if you want, you got to.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some, you know. There's a little problem there. Anyhow, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders here with us live. We're broadcasting from Washington, D.C. from the Families USA Conference. And Dave in Eureka, California. You're live with Bernie.
Oh, wow. I get to. It hasn't happened in months. Senator Bernie, congratulations on the first 100 hours.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm hopeful that very soon the matter of election reform will be hitting the floor, but that's not what I'm calling you about. One of your colleagues, Sam Farr, Congressman of Monterey, California, he's introduced House Resolution 413. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's called for repealing any and all war powers that Congress may have somehow granted to George Bush. It's going to take them back. And it's getting some co-sponsors in the House, and I'd love to see you or some of your colleagues bring it to the floor in the Senate, too. Because
well, we are. I think Senator Kennedy has been a leader on that. And, Dave, what it's about is obviously I voted against giving the president the authority to go to war in the first place. And all of the reasons that he gave us to go to war, ostensibly to deal with weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, turned out to be wrong. Now what the president wants to do is to escalate the war for, again, a totally different purpose. He's not there to remove weapons of mass destruction. No, they're not there. He's there, presumably, to try to do what he could do to calm down or put an end to a civil war. It's a whole different reason than the first reason, the first authority given to him to go to war. So I think what Sam is saying, what Senator Kennedy is saying, what I am saying, is that before you increase the number of troops, before you escalate the war, for a totally different reason, you have to come back to Congress for new authority, and I certainly think that that is the case, so I will be supporting that.
Emmanuel in Richmond, Virginia, listening on WVAX. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes. My question to Senator Sanders is whether Congress can do anything about all this things are coming out from Spirit Rivers trial, all these conspiracy things that are coming up. And also today, the senator from West Virginia, who is now the new chairman of the Judiciary Committee, said that while the Republicans were in control, Cheney was preventing him from launching investigations on what the Republicans were doing.
So,
well, Emmanuel, what I think we can do and what I think will happen is the kinds of investigations now about the role of the vice president in the war in Iraq, in misleading the American people. I think you are going to see those types of investigations, certainly in a way that was not the case over the last 6 years. I know Henry Waxman, for example, who's the chair of the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee. I was on that committee for a number of years, and there are very few people in Congress who are tougher and smarter than is Henry Waxman, and I'm quite confident he's going to do the right thing and asking the right questions and demanding the right answers.
Florian in Arlington Heights, Illinois. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
Hello?
Hello. How are you?
Yeah. Bernie, I caught a bit of the on C-SPAN yesterday, Kent Conrad's budget committee thing. And I was surprised that Peter Orszag is the new director of the CBO. I think it would be very appropriate if he, Orszag, could be tasked to provide a comprehensive cost-benefit analysis for single-payer universal health care,
mm-hmm.
basically Medicare for all.
Mm-hmm.
He's co-author of Saving Social Security, and I found that it was a very level-headed approach at the thing.
That is a very good idea. I am a supporter of single payer. I happen to believe that single payer will eventually become public policy when it is implemented in one or another states and then spreads nationally. I'm not quite so confident it will be done at the national level, but I'm supportive of that as well. And I think your point about having the CBO do a study which can demonstrate how many hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars can be saved by eliminating all of the waste and administrative cost and bureaucracy that is currently part of our horrendous non-system right now is a very, very good idea. I know those studies have been done in Massachusetts. Actually, we did a study in Vermont many, many years ago that I requested, and every study shows that our current system is just enormously wasteful, that we're spending so much money in non-health care needs. We want our health care dollars to be going to doctors, nurses, medicine, not to bureaucrats, not to insurance companies who spend zillions telling us that we're not covered for what we thought we were covered for. So your point is a good point, and that is something that I will be, in fact, whether it's a CBO study or some other approach, it is something that I will be striving for.
Lou in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, good afternoon, guys. Bernie, my question is, being an independent, and you ran, and you're saying that there's no difference between a Democrat and Republican, and you're running for the Senate and won the Senate seat. Why did you do that?
Well, I'm not saying that there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. What I have said is the Republican Party today is a right-wing extremist party. The Democratic Party is a centrist party, maybe a left-center party. There is a very fundamental and strong difference between the two. I run as an independent because I believe that historically the Democratic Party has not been strong enough in taking on big money interest and standing up for working families and the middle class. But in the House for 16 years and in the Senate now, I am caucusing and working with the Democrats, get my committee assignments from the Democrats, and I'm going to try to make the Democrats as progressive as they can possibly be. But to say that there's not a difference between right-wing extremism and people like Byron Dorgan or Pat Leahy or Russ Feingold, I think that would be quite incorrect.
And, in fact, didn't you start the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives?
Yes. Yeah.
Terry in Springfield, Oregon. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
Hey, I was wondering if it would be possible, since it looks like we can't cut the funding for the escalation, is to put the onus back on Bush and actually put amendment in that requiring him to actually pay for it by doing something like repeal the tax cuts on the richest people, and maybe another amendment that would prohibit corporations like Albertan from making a profit while over there, and then put the onus and see how badly he really wants.
I think you are going to see. In fact, I'm a member of the Budget Committee, and those are exactly the kinds of things that my staff and I are working on right now. I want to stop the escalation. I don't want it to be funded. But in general, the idea that we do not have adequate funding in this country to make sure that all of our young people are able to go to college or afford college without getting out deeply in debt, the idea that our child care system is a disaster, that Head Start is grossly underfunded, that we're not taking proper care of our veterans, that we have a major crisis in affordable housing, and that we're not trying to address those problems at the same time as Bush gave hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%, has allowed many of these corporations to run to the Cayman Islands or Bermuda to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. Trust me, I am a member of the Budget Committee, and we will be working very, very hard on all of these issues. The wealthy and large corporations have got to start paying their fair share of taxes. It can't come out of the middle class.
Amen. Casey in Seattle, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, sirs. It's an honor. Congratulations, Mr. Sanders.
Thank you very much, Casey.
This question, really quick, it's off the subject of everything else, so sorry. But I just wondered, in some areas of the country, it's more likely for a black male between 15 and 25 to die from homicide than it was for a United States soldier to be killed on a tour of duty in Vietnam, which is a quote from the New York Times, and that was in 1990. So instead of going into more statistics, I just was wondering, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this, but...
Casey, I got your point, and it is a very good point.
Like, I think if it was, like, white kids in the suburbs that were murdering each other like that, I'm pretty sure America would be like, you know, this is a crisis.
Well, I think you make a good point, and it is a crisis. In fact, the point that you're making, and I don't remember the exact statistic, but if you look among young black males who are either in jail, on probation, or on parole, what was it, Tom? Something
it's about 10% of the entire population.
More than that?
Or was it?
Of the black population.
Yeah.
More than that.
Uh-huh.
More than that. It was really a stunning figure. Uh-huh. Yesterday, there was a very good piece in the New York Times, which reported on a study done by the Center for American Progress, which talked about the horrendous economic impact of the fact that we do have such a high rate of childhood poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And Casey's question really relates to that.
Yeah, and also that racism is still alive
and
in all of the United States.
And racism is still alive, absolutely.
Tragically.
So what you have is, and the studies indicate this, that if kids are growing up in poverty, if they're growing up in broken homes, if they're going to inadequate schools, if they're getting into trouble when they are young, what ends up happening is that they're going to end up in jail. You can go to any small town in America, maybe a large city as well, but I know in Vermont, and you can find the local police chief introducing you to the kid who will be in jail in 5 years. Everybody knows what is happening. And the cost in terms of human suffering, in both from victims of crime as well as the people who end up in jail, the wasted lives, the wasted money is enormous. And we have got to start investing in our children so that we don't end up with the statistics that Casey is talking about.
And the best anti-poverty program and the best to solve race relations is a good union job for everybody. Get people back to work. 45 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. The place where despair is not an option. Get out there. Get active, my friends. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, the Tom Hartman radio program. Jay in Bainbridge Island, you are live with Bernie Sanders.
Oh, thank you, Senator.
How are you doing, Jay?
I'm fine. I'm a little nervous here. I thought I needed to tell you I'm a veteran from the Cold War, and I've used the veterans' hospitals, and they've been good. Until the late president did his thing. At any rate, what I want to tell you is, until last year, we could call from 1 until 8 o'clock on weekdays, last year, late. We could only call from 12 to 4, 5 days a week.
And to call up, to call, Jay, to call your local VA hospital?
Yes. So that's just a small point.
No, it is not a small point. It is a big point, and I'm shocked and disappointed to hear that. That's just an outrage.
Yes, sir. Well, let me tell you the next little trick. They send appointment cards always and give us two numbers to call to make the appointment, usually a month ahead of time. And this year, for the first time, I dialed one number, and I got a voiceover, and whether it was the phone company or somebody else or one of the Bush buddies, I do not know, but they said, well, the lines are busy, but if you'll agree to pay 95 cents, we'll call you back as soon as the line is free. And I
that might have been your phone company, Jay.
Well,
some phone companies are starting to do that on a busy, you know, on a busy signal, but you shouldn't have got a busy signal when you call the VA.
Well, then I stayed on the line because I chose not to do that, and then I got dumped 8 minutes later. So I called the second number and got the same story, only it was 75 cents. And I don't know how many people call.
Maybe this is.
Well, Jay, thank you for that information. In fact, we just met. I'm on the Veterans Committee. And the issue of substantially increasing funding for the VA so that there aren't any waiting lines, so that veterans like you don't have the problems that you have just told us about, is something that we must, as a nation, address. We can disagree about the war in Iraq or Vietnam or anything else, but in my view, when people put their lives on the line defending this country, they should not be treated the way that you have been treated and the way that other veterans all over this country are being treated today. And I worry very much that as bad as the situation is today, given the 20-plus thousand soldiers that have been wounded in Iraq, given the many soldiers who are coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder, that this president, this administration, are not prepared to deal with that problem. And I wanted to tell you, Jay, that some of us in the Budget Committee are going to fight as hard as we can to substantially increase funding for the VA. We're not going to let this president raise prescription drug fees, raise other types of fees for our veterans. Very important issue. We're not going to give tax breaks to billionaires and tell veterans they can't get the health care that they were promised.
What about just moving the Veterans Administration budget from discretionary to non-discretionary?
That's an issue, absolutely. Yeah. That is an issue that something that I strongly believe in.
Good. Dave in Burlington, Vermont. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hello, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I love you, Bernie. Okay, so I have a question. Now, the new Congress has repeatedly said that they will not fund any more money for the new troops going into Iraq.
Now, Dave, let me jump in. This is my fellow Burlingtonian. Some of us in Congress have said that.
Right.
Some of us. We're a minority, to be honest with you.
Well, but there are congressmen saying are against funding any
yes,
new troops. Okay.
That is true.
So now, all of a sudden, the Bush baby comes out and says, okay, I need 10-point-some-odd billion dollars to fight the war in Afghanistan. Okay? Now, my question is, how do we know, we as American people and the Congress, know that's where the money goes?
Well, that's a good question, and that's why you are going to see now the kind of oversight, the kind of investigations, the kind of demands made on the Bush administration and on the Pentagon that you have not seen for many, many years. So that's the answer, that for the first time since Bush has been president, the United States Congress is going to accept its constitutional responsibility, provide oversight, make sure that, to the best that we can, that where money is supposed to go, in fact, it goes there and doesn't go someplace else.
Robert in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Mr. Sanders. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Robert.
Regarding Congress taking back its authority to declare war, I feel that we have a Gulf of Tonkin issue probably in the next 2 or 3 weeks in Iran, and I don't think Congress will be afraid, Democrats in Congress will be able to oppose Cheney. I think they'll have AIPAC and Rahm Emanuel looking over their shoulder, and they'll be forced to go along with this basically escalation into World War III.
I think that a number of us I hope very much that you are wrong. I hope very much that this president is not intending, although to go to war in Iran. That would be just literally beyond comprehension. Your point is a good point. If what you mean is that Congress has got to be vigorous right now, and Joe Biden, among others, the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, has made that clear, that this president cannot go to war in Iran without coming before the United States Congress, and I know that I won't give him that authority, and I would hope that a majority will not. But if he thinks he can simply go to war whenever he wants to, wherever he wants to, he really doesn't understand how the United States government functions.
Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment, thanks so much for being with us, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It is always an honor to have you on the program and a pleasure. Tom Harbin here with you. I'll be back after the news at the top of the hour, 1-866-440-THOM. Our telephone number, if you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com. We'll get you there. We'll be right back.
Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. We're broadcasting live from the Families USA Conference in Washington, D.C., getting ready for the big riot. No, not a riot. The big protest. Tomorrow, it should be really interesting here in Washington D.C. We're going to have a few guests on as we go through the next 2 hours, and we'll also be taking your telephone calls 1-866-440-8466. A lot happening in the news. Apparently, Dick Cheney thinks that he owns Tim Russert. You know, this is like, you know, special to Tim Russert. Dick Cheney owns you. Thank you. This is yesterday in the Scooter Libby trial. Vice President Cheney's former communications director displayed notes from 2004. You get it? This is the guy who is in charge of communications for Cheney. He presents in court. I mean, this is like testimony under oath. This is the true stuff, right? About how Cheney could respond to allegations that the Bush administration had played fast and loose with evidence of Iraq's nuclear ambitions. Option one was, quote, MTP-VP. Now, what does this mean? Well, it meant go on the Tim Russert, you know, on Meet the Press, MTP, Meet the Press, that the VP should go on there, because Cheney could, quote, control the message, end quote. In fact, here's the exact quote from the communications director, Cheney's communications director. He says, I suggested we put the vice president on Meet the Press, which was a tactic we often used. You know, I've been saying for a long time, if it's Sunday, it must be right wing, right? I mean, you get all these right wingers on all the time. So, anyhow, Kathleen, hey, welcome. First of all, I'll shake your hand, have a seat, put your headphones. We're live and on the air right now. And Kathleen Stoll is with us. She's the director of health policy at Families USA, national nonprofit organization dedicated to achievement of high-quality, affordable health care for all Americans. And Kathleen, here we are. We're at the Families USA Conference. How's it going? What's the state of health care in America, and what's the state of Families USA? You're the director of health policy here. Hang on just a minute. Let me turn your microphone on. There you go.
Okay. We're having a wonderful conference. It's really pretty exciting. We have, for one thing, we have more people here than we've ever had in the past, because I think there's this growing national momentum to really do some healthcare reform in this country and to really start acting to cover more uninsured. Families USA is a national organization. We're dedicated to ensuring that every American has comprehensive, affordable health care. We've got 700-800 people with us here today who want to join us in that fight.
Mm-hmm. That's marvelous. That's absolutely marvelous. Now, a number of big-name politicians have been cycling through here. You had Barack Obama yesterday. Tom Daschle and I were talking. He was on my morning show a little earlier. How much political courage is there out there, frankly? I mean, I don't know how to say it beyond that. The reality is that the health insurance industry stalks the halls of Congress with dollars falling out of their wallets and briefcases and pockets and whatnot. And my experience has been that there's very few politicians who are willing to stand up to them.
I think right now we have a unique opportunity to see that kind of strengthening of the spine, stiffening of the spine. Although there's 47 million uninsured, and that's hard to think about where's the solution lie,
yeah.
There seems to be consensus on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, that we need to take action to cover all uninsured kids. 9 million uninsured kids in the country.
What about all uninsured people? What about cradle to grave? What about going with a system like they have in the Scandinavian countries, where even your old age, the equivalent of nursing care is all paid for? We have a death tax in the United States right now, and it's not the death tax that Grover Norquist talks about. It's that if you're a middle class family and you've saved all your life and finally paid off your house and you've got a little bit of an asset there, and you get Alzheimer's, you get sick, your spouse dies. I mean, I'm watching this right now. My father died, my mother has Alzheimer's. You get in that situation and you have to bankrupt yourself. You have to wipe out absolutely everything you own in order to be poor enough to qualify for Medicare to provide for long-term care. Why in the United States, this supposedly richest country in the world, do we have this obscenity?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. But what we have is a democracy that requires bipartisan compromise, bipartisan support of any action that we want to take. We want to cover 47 million uninsured, and we'd like to do it tomorrow. But we also believe we have to be politically pragmatic, and we need bipartisan support, and we have this budget deficit problem. I don't worry about a budget deficit, but the members of Congress on both sides of the aisle do. And it's not cheap to cover the uninsured. Kids are cheaper, though. So let's bite off a chunk of what we can actually chew and cover kids, all kids, 9 million kids first. That gives our movement some momentum. It gives us success. It also provides important services and investment in our future. And then we take the next step, if you will, phase two. We start thinking about how to cover parents, adults, everyone in the country.
Yeah. It's an incremental process, I suppose.
We like to think of it as sequential.
Sequential. Kathleen, we're talking with Kathleen Stoll, Director of Health Policy at Families USA. What is Families USA doing to bring this about?
Well, right now we have a couple things we're doing. One, we have a national campaign to help people join with us in support of covering all kids. And our target is Congress and the adequate funding of a program called the State Children's Health Insurance Program. We're asking people across the country to go to our website, familiesusa.org, sign a petition that says we want kids covered now. And we're fighting to make sure there's enough money in the federal budget so that we can at least accomplish that goal.
Right, and you're not taking the position of here's how to make it happen or here's how to make it happen. You're just saying make it happen, right? Yeah, I mean, in other words, leave the political fighting to the politicians.
Well, no, actually.
Is there a favored plan then that you're recommending?
Well, we are a part of a really unique coalition. It's 16 groups across the political spectrum. It's called the Health Coverage Coalition for the Uninsured. It includes the Chamber of Commerce, American Medical Association, health insurance plans. There are a lot of groups at the table with us who have been the people who have fought health care reform in the past. The Harry and Louise ad folks, back when we attempted to expand coverage under the Clinton period. All of those folks have come together. We've agreed to a framework for how we can proceed. It is a balance of public and private programs. It has appeal across the aisle, bipartisan support. Phase one is all kids, and it's all kids through a solid foundation of public programs for the lowest income folks, and then it moves into a tax credit for higher income kids. And then we have a phase two that does something similar for adults. So we're actually talking about a pragmatic solution that we feel Congress can work at, look at, adjust, tweak.
Sure.
But we're not just saying do it and we don't know how.
But when you divide the amount of dollars that are spent on health care in the United States by the population, you get a number that's a little over $6,000 per person for every man, woman, and child in this country. When you do the same thing in Japan, which has universal health care and a very good system and a lower infant mortality rate than the United States and a longer lifespan than the United States, better health by any measure. You do the same thing in Japan, comes out to about $2,700 a person. we're over 6,000. You do the same thing in Germany, it comes out to about $2,800 a person. Canada is the most expensive of all the countries, all the industrialized countries. That's $3,002 per person. So we're paying twice as much as anybody else. And when you look at where that money is going, it's going into the pockets of corporations that are not actually directly providing health care. You've got a bunch of leeches on the back of the American system here. Why have any private in this at all? Why craft a solution that continues to carry these, frankly, leeches, for lack of a better word?
We could try to go there. It might take us 40 years. The reality right now is that we have a healthcare system.
You don't think Americans are pissed off enough that if you just said, these companies are bleeding us dry, let's get rid of them, that they would go along with it?
I think we'll see some of that tested in the upcoming election cycle for the president. I don't know. I hope you're right. I think it would be hard to move the system on a quick basis to a single-payer system, something like we see in Europe and Canada. And for me, as an advocate for low-income people, right now I have 47 million uninsured people in the country who are not getting to a doctor at all, and I can't wait for us to get there in 10 years. Yeah. I need to begin to solve the solution for them now in ways that put us on the path to that vision.
Well, Kathleen Stoll, I applaud your pragmatism. I think it's great that you're working on it. I hope that America can move even faster. And I know that would make you very, very happy as well.
May you be, you know, from your lips to God's ears.
Okay, thanks a lot for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour.
I wouldn't screw up the environment or the money for retirement like the liberals complain. I'd impress all my poo-pooers, shocking all the evildoers, if I only had a brain. Now I'd pronunciate much better, honor liberties to the letter, for the folks that we detain. And when the world called me a baddie, I wouldn't run off to my daddy, if I only had a brain.
And welcome back, Tom Harmon here with you. Oh my goodness, Rush Limbaugh. Sometimes you get it's hard to even understand the thinking behind it. This is I can't play music here, Frank. Since I'm doing a remote here, I'd play our Limbaugh alert. But just pretend in your mind it's a Limbaugh alert. A lot of people have tried to explain liberals. It's a tough thing to do because people who aren't liberal, it's a tough challenge to try to get outside yourself enough to understand these people. Most of them are miserable. Most of them are unhappy. Most of them really don't really matter. Don't amount to much and resent anybody else who does. Yeah. Yeah, those liberals like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Teddy Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, and Franklin Roosevelt. It's tragic. Top this from Think Progress. A top conservative Capitol Hill staffer tells Politico, it's the new political newsletter out there, that more than 70 senators would oppose Bush's escalation if their vote matched their comments in private meetings. Staffer says the White House is trying to, but they really don't know how to handle this. Now let's hope that some of these senators actually start speaking up. And also, I know this will shock you, and it won't shock you. I mean, that's the level of the stuff that's starting to come out. And I'm telling you, the gates are going to open. This is just the initial trickle. Right? Nancy Pelosi had her 100 hours. She got done what she wanted to get done. Now people are starting to look into what really was going on. In an interview with, again, from Think Progress, in an interview with McClatchy newspaper, Senator John Rockefeller said that Vice President Dick Cheney exerted, quote, constant pressure, end quote, on the former chairman, Senator Pat Roberts, a Republican of Kansas, to stall an investigation into the Bush administration's use of false intelligence on Iraq. This is the phase two part of the report. Remember that? Everybody was always saying, where's phase two? What about phase two? It's all, you know, it's about all about how Bush and Cheney cooked the books, how they lied us into a war to advance their own political goals and help their buddies get rich. Two of its five portions were finally released in 2006. Three-fifths of it is still buried. Rockefeller said that he knew that Cheney attended regular policy meetings in which he conveyed White House directions to conservative Capitol Hill staffers. They just had to go along with the administration, he said. Well, this is absolutely incredible. Pat Roberts, who I've been a little concerned about ever since he was on Meet the Press 6-8 months ago, and pulled a prescription bottle out of his pocket and said, these are the only memory pills around. And I thought, uh-oh, because there's only one prescription medication that I know of that you could call a memory pill, and it's for Alzheimer's. But anyhow, it's concerning. George W. Bush, again, saying he's the decider, he's the decision maker, he knows what's best. It doesn't matter what Congress said. It doesn't matter what the people of the United States say. Just plain old flat out doesn't matter. Tim Russert, owned by Dick Cheney, according to testimony in the Scooter Libby trial, that's pulling back the curtain and letting us see a little bit of weirdness in there. Prime Minister al-Maliki's presentation of a new Baghdad security plan to the Iraqi parliament yesterday, quote, broke down in bitter sectarian recriminations. This from over at Huffington Post, with Mr. Maliki threatening a Sunni Arab lawmaker with arrest, and in response, the Sunni Speaker of the Parliament threatening to quit. They did, however, eventually approve the plan. I guess that's the good news in the whole thing. And Russ Feingold, God bless him, chairman of the Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on the Constitution, has scheduled a hearing next Tuesday to explore whether Congress has the authority to cut off funding for the war in Iraq. He says, and I quote, this is Russ Feingold, he said, this hearing will help inform my colleagues and the public about Congress's power to end a war and how that power has been used in the past. That's pretty important stuff. I think it's very important stuff. And in case you didn't notice that this, here in Washington, I got up this morning here in Washington, D.C., and the Washington Post in front of my door and in the hotel, and the U.S., the White House, has authorized the U.S. military to kill Iranians found in Iraq. Now, the problem here is that the Prime Minister of Iraq went to Iran and met with the President of Iran. They have a mutual cooperation agreement. They have a mutual non-aggression agreement. These two countries are allies of each other's. And Iraq has said that they would welcome some help from Iran. I'm assuming that, you know, the White House is saying, okay, we're only going to go after people who are doing, what, harmful stuff, bad stuff, whatever that may be. But, man, the way that they paint these things with broad brushes, and this could be again perceived by the Shiites in Iraq as America taking a Sunni position, and, you know, more blowback, more Medi Army, more solder coming after us. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-440-THOM, our number. We'll be back with your calls right after this. And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Paul in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. Hey, Paul's. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've been thinking of calling you for a while because in the past you've talked about the parallels between some of the documents and some of the processes related to Hitler's rise to power, and if you substitute words in it, how it looks an awful lot like what's happening now. And I just finished reading a book called The Dark Side of Christian History.
Oh, by Linda...
Helen Ellerbe is the author.
Helen Ellerbe, that's right. I was thinking Linda because of Linda Ellerbe of, what is it, PBS or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I've read that book.
Yeah, I was struck by the follow the money idea of absolute power, where if you are... if you find an enemy that you can identify as a heretic or a terrorist, and there happens to be a significant amount of money involved in taking over, the Inquisition, they frequently picked the highest income areas and
that's right. They went after the wealthy Jews or the wealthy Muslims, and Hitler did the same thing.
And as soon as they ran out of enough people to get through the Inquisition, then the witch burnings began. Yeah. So it was a process of going after both religious and financial interests.
Well, a lot of the witch burnings also had to do with financial interests as well, because an awful lot of that started going after basically what were midwives and nurse practitioners, as it were. They were not the official physicians. And the church, to a large extent during what we refer to as the Dark Ages, had a semi-monopoly on the healing business as well as the religious business. And having women who are herbalists and things, I mean, the whole realm was something where they were confronting economic interests as well as political and powerful interests.
And you mix that with the inability of anyone to challenge the people in power, because the power was not open to question.
Yeah, it was absolute. Yeah, the problem that I had with reading that book was that it was so dark. And also it was, so heavily focused on an awful lot of it was focused on what happened hundreds of years ago. It would be nice to read a book that balanced the dark side of Christian history, which is very real, just as is the dark side of the history of probably every religion on earth, with the light side of Christian history as well. I mean, there's been some very good things that have been done by Christianity and the name of Christianity over the years, and frankly, I think an awful lot of those are not the things that get done out in the world that are as visible as they are just the being there and providing inspiration and meaning for people.
And I agree with you absolutely. The strongest part for me was the corruption that happens when you combine church, state, and money interest.
Yeah, you're right, Paul. Thanks a lot for the call. It's a thought-provoking. Conversation. It is that was a very thought-provoking book. It's been about 2 years since I read it, but I remember it well. Dwayne in Livermore, California. Hey, Dwayne, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Oh, good.
How about you, Dwayne?
I'm doing fantastic. I really love your show, and I used to be a conservative Republican until the Republicans lost their mind under Bush.
Yeah.
Now I'm a conservative libertarian.
Okay, until they all went insane. Well, I'll tell you, you're still halfway there, Dwayne. Maybe I can help rescue you. But so what's up?
When you had Bernie Sanders on.
Bernie Sanders.
I'm sorry. He mentioned something that always kind of catches my interest when people start mentioning the term middle class and using it in sort of an ambiguous term, because it really is almost hyperbole and a subterfuge at this point, because it, depending on where you are in the country, middle class means a lot of different things. I live in the Bay Area, and if you're making $40,000 a year in the Bay Area here, you're dirt poor.
You're the working
poor. Yeah, exactly. Well, I would say very poor. You're very, very poor making that much. But if you're in someplace like Arkansas making $40,000 a year, you're probably fairly well to do.
Yeah, I agree with you that it's hard to define the middle class in dollars. I think, though, that there are some very specific criteria that you can use to define what the middle class is. And the criteria that have defined the two great periods of middle class in the United States, the mid-1700s and the mid-1900s. And that is that, number one, with a single paycheck, a person can raise a family. With a single paycheck, a person can own a home. With a single, eventually, over a period of time, over the course of their productive life, they can end up fully owning their home. With a single paycheck, a person can have a decent retirement. With a single paycheck, a person can put their kids through school and even help their children go through college. And with a single paycheck, they know that they have security if they get sick. Those are the defining characteristics of the middle class as Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican president, defined them back in 1907 when he first coined the phrase living wage. and said, you know, we should raise all Americans to this. This is the, and this is frankly what was referred to as the American dream for you know, most of the period of time, from the time that Teddy Roosevelt started using that phrase until Ronald Reagan basically reinvented the thing. And then, you know, in the last 20 years or so, people have said, well, the American dream is to become like Bill Gates. No, the American dream has always been to be the middle class, as I described it. And you're right. In rural Arkansas, that might mean $40,000, $45,000 a year income, or even $30,000, $35,000 a year income. If you're going to live in downtown San Francisco, you're probably going to have to make $70,000, $80,000 in order to, you know, at least in order to have that kind of a standard of living. But, you know, therefore what?
I agree with, you know, what you said, the way middle class should be defined, you know, sort of, you know, in a relative sense. It would be nice that, you know, from the political aspect, you know, when politicians, you know, pass laws and they go to evaluate people's taxes and stuff, they would take that into consideration.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Duane. Thanks a lot for the call. Robert in Berkeley, California. Hey, Robert.
Thanks for taking the call. My issue has to do with the, what I think is a lot of misinformation about the immigration crisis. I think it should be traced back to NAFTA. I haven't heard a lot about that. And also the giant subsidies given to the big agriculture.
Yeah, I would suggest that if you look at the American-Mexican border back in the 1950s, on average about 1 million people a year came north, and on average about 1 million people a year went south. In other words, they would come north, they would work through a season, and then they would go back to Mexico. What happened after Reagan's 1986 amnesty was that 1 million people a year are still coming north, but they weren't going south anymore. And because between the amnesty and the basically the cons, they all got the wink and the nod, and all these companies across America figured out that they could hire people who are not U.S. citizens with essentially no penalty whatsoever, and pay lower wages than they would have to pay to citizens. And what this did was it had the, from the conservative point of view, desirable effect of increasing the labor force beyond the demand level, which has the predictable effect of driving down the cost of labor, driving down wages. I mean, it's really simple. Wages go down as a consequence of the labor pool increasing faster than the demand for the labor pool. And so, as I've said many times, we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States, because we've always had a porous border with Mexico. We've always had a porous border with Canada. But the fact of the matter is, if you go to Canada, as my son, his girlfriend is Canadian, and she lives in Toronto, and I mean, he just discovered this firsthand. You go to Canada, and you try and get a job, and you're not a Canadian. You know, you are just plain old flat out of luck. It just ain't happening. And the same thing is true of Mexico. If you go to Mexico and try and get a job and you're not a Mexican, and it ain't going to happen. In fact, you can be prosecuted for it. But in the United States, we've had for 20 years now, since 86, since Reagan's amnesty, we've had this shift in our policies, and the consequence of the shift in our policies has been that we're letting in people like crazy, left and right, and they're continuing to work. We need to basically start enforcing the laws that we already have and put some of these employers in jail. I mean, it's just real simple. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I got a quick question for you. When Bernie mentioned single-payer health care system,
yeah.
when I try to talk to my friends about the benefits of that system, mm-hmm. I get stuck on the question about how are doctors paid.
They get a check from the insurance company, which in this case is the federal government.
Then who sets the wage?
That's a good question. In different countries, they do it in different ways, but the bottom line typically is that essentially there's a negotiation between the physicians and the government. You know, they say, I'm willing to work for this, and the government says, we're willing to pay that. And occasionally they come into collision. In England, there have been several medical strikes, for example, you know, where the healthcare professionals went on strike. Ultimately, you know, they get paid what they want to get paid.
Right. The country wouldn't want there to be too few doctors.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right. And in fact, right now, even, you know, we have a certain level of regulation of the number of doctors. Again, going back to this whole thing about the, the number of people in the, you know, the Ricardo's iron law of wages, the number of people in the workforce will define the price of labor in that workforce.
Mm-hmm.
By the AMA controlling the number of people who can go to medical school and limiting it, they're driving up the wages of physicians, and that's something that most other countries don't do as well. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you at the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be back with Victoria Jones right after this.
I'm the decider, and I decide what is best. I'm the decider.
I figured that it couldn't be too difficult.
So I hear the voices.
To be president of the USA.
I read the front page, and I know the speculation.
I saw my dad do it. How hard could it be? Then the office finally came to me. Now I'm in control. I'm the decider.
He's the decider.
Not a doubt in my mind.
Yes. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, along with Victoria Jones, the lovely, witty, and world famous. Let me turn your mic on here. You and I were standing someplace, and somebody came up and said, "I love seeing you on TV."
That's right.
Yesterday?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The TV star, the star of radio and television.
Yes, star of radio and television. At least, yes. World famous in my own living room.
Well, apparently in Washington, D.C. I didn't know that you were a talking head here.
Yeah, I'm a talking head. Yeah. I am. I'm a talking head. I do food fights.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
So, Victoria Jones, what's happening in the news today here?
Well, Nancy Pelosi is headed to Baghdad for the weekend with John Murtha and a group of other various people.
Oh, really?
In Congress.
Is this her first trip to Iraq?
I think she may have been before. This is certainly her first trip as Speaker, obviously. She's going to be meeting with top leaders. Who they are was not spelled out in the article I read.
Ahmed Chalabi?
Yeah.
I mean, who's really in charge,
yeah,
right?
Well, scary.
Yeah.
But apparently no public appearances are planned, which makes you think maybe this is a serious trip, because if it was just for show, obviously she would be having public appearances.
Yeah.
John Murtha going adds a bit of interest to the trip also, I think.
Yeah.
So that's going on. What's the other thing? Oh, yes, she's also said in an interview, which I thought was quite interesting, I'm sure you've seen this, that when she met with the president to ask him about the surge in troops and why he was doing it and why it would work this time when he'd done it twice before, he said because he told them that they had to.
Oh, right. And the question that immediately comes to mind is, why didn't you tell them you have to the last two times?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
This is bizarre.
Yeah, and his reason for why it's going to work is because I told them that they have to.
Yeah, that's...
Today, he didn't say he was the decider today, but I think he said something like, I get to decide, or I'm in charge. He said something along those lines today in reply to some reporters' questions. He reminded us, as if we didn't know, that he gets to make the decisions.
Yeah. It's amazing. Well, it's Friday. It's you know, we can talk about anything at all, and let's take a phone call or two here. Hey, Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Tomas, you're live with me and Victoria Jones sitting here with me with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Tomas, he's up. He's
not there.
Oh, yeah, grab the phone. Nope. Okay, we'll put Tomas on hold. He's got to listen to his telephone. Charlie in Freeport, Pennsylvania. Hey, Charlie.
Oh, God bless you, Tom Hartman. I don't get a chance to listen all the time, but I'll try to be brief as I can. A while back, you know, everybody's talking about, especially the Main Street media here, is all talking about Barack Obama. I just want to remind folks that he's not a progressive. A while back here around election time, I was looking up Santorum, and I looked for who voted for. He voted for tort reform with the Republicans. He voted for the free trade agreement with Oman, and that's where labor unions are illegal.
Yeah.
And then he votes, he goes up in Connecticut and raises funds for Lieberman against Ed Lamont.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but nobody's ever bringing this out.
Yeah, you know? But he's very handsome.
He might be, but he might be a Democrat, but he's not a progressive.
Yeah, well, see, that's the bad news, Charlie, and you're absolutely right, as far as I know, on all those points. And there are others as well. I mean, there's a lot of bones that we can pick with Mr. Obama, we progressives. On the other hand, He is a rising star in the Democratic Party, and mm-hmm. if he becomes the nominee for vice president or for president, I'm guessing vice president. If
I would think vice president,
like an Edwards Obama ticket or a Clinton Obama ticket, something like that. That if that happens, that his positions are the result of his perception that those are the appropriate positions for him to be taking. I do, my sense of it, and Victoria, correct me if I'm wrong, and Charlie, thanks for calling up and raising this issue. Victoria, my sense of it is that there are some members of Congress who take positions because somebody crossed their palms with cash. And not in a bad way, not in a Duke Cunningham way, but mm-hmm. I mean, they realize, I mean, a senator has to raise about $20,000 a day to come up with the $6 million, when you think of it. You take $6 million a year and you divide it by the number of business days there are, it's $20,000 a day. And so, you know, they're listening to these interests. And I think that that's the reason why some of these, for example, a bankruptcy bill. You know, there are senators that it's just no way that they could justify that. Or my member of Congress, for example, in the House of Representatives, Darlene Hooley. I mean, I had her on the program and talked, you know, confronted her about it. You know, said, you know, why would you, you know, and she gives me this all this platitudes about, you know, we've got to do it because people have to be held accountable and all that.
Oh, please, crying out loud.
Yeah, I just
we
don't
have
buy
to
it.
Punish them.
I know.
Go paddle them.
And the thing is, Darlene Hooley, I think, is otherwise a decent representative. I mean, she's my member of Congress. And I voted for her, in fact. Well, that's the thing. There is that political reality that sometimes people have to do what they're being paid to do. But there's also a number of people who speak of conviction, out of conviction. You know, Bernie Sanders, obviously the case in point. I think, you know, Ron Paul, the conservative from Texas. Peter DeFazio in Oregon. These are people who, it doesn't matter who's giving them what money, they're gonna vote the way that they're gonna vote. And my sense of it is that Barack Obama is more in that latter category than in the former category. What's your sense of that?
I would agree with you. I think he is.
Yeah, so he's following the parade. And the problem is, his perception is that the parade is not quite progressive. And what we need to do is we need to be convincing him that, no, the parade, we the people, all of us out here, we are that progressive. This is the kind of America that most Americans want to have. And I think he'll get with the program. I hope he'll get with the program. I've seen it before, and politicians change in their mind as a result of constituent pressure. So I think that that's what we need to be doing. We'll continue taking your calls into the next hour and also the news of the day. 57 minutes past the hour. Victoria, thank you for being
here.
Thank you. TalkRadioNews.com for all things Victoria and all things Talk Radio News. 57 minutes past the hour right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. It's a Friday. I'm doing the program here from the Radio Row at the Families USA Conference. Great fun. Fine time we're having. Ellen Ratner just sat down across from you. Ellen, would you like to go on the air with me for a moment? Here's a pair of headphones here for you. Let me turn up open your mic. And how's everything going with the conference?
I think it's going actually very well. And Kennedy got this huge applause. And, of course, you saw the love of our lives, Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, well, he sat here for an hour, as he does every Friday.
Oh, he does?
Oh,
you have him for an hour?
For three and a half years, Bernie has come on this program every Friday.
Yeah.
And what we do, the format is for the first 15 minutes, he and I talk, and, you know, mostly he rants. And then we open the phone lines, and I just get out of the way. I just say, you know, Ralph in Minnesota, you're on with Bernie. John in Long Beach, you're on with Bernie. And he will take any question on any topic. We pretty much take them in the order that they come in. And he slams the lines every day. And
I'm in love with him.
He's incredible. He's absolutely incredible. And he's, you know, he was sitting here. We were talking during the break, and he's new to the Senate, right? And he says, if you're having any problems getting any of these big-name senators on your show, I'd be glad to help out, you know. And I said, I don't want them. And he's like, why? And I said, because the last couple of times I've had these people, I've had a couple of these people on, I've asked them tough questions, or I've, you know, hey, what about that bankruptcy bill? You know, come on,
right.
Give me a break on this. You know, we all know that most bankruptcies are caused by, you know, and they, and afterwards, on two occasions, I've had chiefs of staff call up my producer or call up me and say, what the hell did you think you were doing, confronting the senator like that on live radio? And I'm just like,
but
you know, they all want suck up interviews.
I had a situation with Claire McCaskill the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in Statuary Hall right after State of the Union, and she was going on and on about what we need to do for military readiness. So I said, Senator, the studies have shown that you could have 40,000 people tomorrow if you allowed gay people to serve openly, new people.
Right.
And she just said, well, I don't know about any of those studies. And so I pressed her, and I said, well, there are studies like that, and, you know, there's...
It's
veterans,
etc.
And she just flipped. She couldn't handle it.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing.
Now, this is supposedly our Democratic Senate.
I know.
Give me a break.
I know. And so I just decided a long time ago, I'm not going to do suck up interviews with people. And
well, I still like to do the suck ups.
From time to time, if there's a really important issue, I will put somebody on with whom I disagree on a whole bunch of other things, but, you know, I do want to talk to them about that one issue, and I'm not going to antagonize them with all the disagreements,
right,
because that one issue needs to be discussed. But by and large, I just think it makes tragic radio. I just don't think
it does make tragic radio, but, you know, I'll tell you, in getting dealing with I have to in Mississippi and that kind of thing,
yeah,
it's been actually very helpful for me to have friendly relationships with these characters.
Well, you're a member of the press.
Right.
Your job is to maintain relationships,
right,
with them. And I know that you have very good friends who are Republicans. In fact, you introduced me to one this morning, good friends who are Democrats. And I really honor that in you, Ellen, that you're able to bridge those worlds.
It's helpful. If you live in this town, you can't, you know, you kind of got to do it.
Right, right.
So I do the suck-ups. But I say they're suck-ups.
But as a talk show host, I mean, I
right.
I, no, my
I
job is to have
you.
An opinion.
I think you do a better program for not having it.
Yeah, and I just and so by and large, and occasionally I'll have
Kennedy. You can usually get pretty good stuff out of.
Yeah, but I also know what he's going to say in advance.
Right.
You know, I mean, so it's almost at that
but
point.
But a lot of other people don't necessarily know what Kennedy's going to say.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think Kennedy, you can get an honest thing. I think that it. Part of an interesting issue of getting a suck-up interview from somebody about Hillary Clinton is watching how she says things.
Yeah.
I was at a small event, and, you know, she was asked about torture, and she went against it. And then she said, and then what do you do about the ticking bomb?
Oh, jeez.
You know, I mean.
Oh, jeez. Not as if we haven't had legislation to deal with that,
exactly,
basically since the founding of this country. I mean, you know, it's...
But so suck-ups are, you know, sometimes suck-ups are useful in terms of what they won't say.
Yeah, they reveal,
right,
they go a little beyond. And occasionally I'll have on, you know, politicians who are not nationally, you know, they're not the publicity hounds, you know.
Right.
Jim McDermott is one of my favorite guys. He's from Seattle.
I love Jim McDermott. Dr. McDermott,
yes,
the psychiatrist.
That's right. And he's just a good, honest, decent person who, John Boehner is still, or Bonner,
Boehner,
thank you, is still suing him. For outing Newt Gingrich when Newt Gingrich was breaking the law. And,
right.
And I mean, he's still suing him. I emceed a fundraiser for him up in Seattle for Jim McDermott.
Really?
With Bill Clinton, yeah. And because he's got like a $700,000 legal bill. But he just came back from Iraq, and so, you know, we had him on the show a couple days ago because, I thought, A, he just came back from Iraq. He was prescient.
Our very own Shalene Espinoza wants to go to Iraq again, and I'm
You're
saying
no.
No.
Yeah.
And actually, at your book party, there was somebody who I introduced you to, who on this show will remain nameless, but I introduced you to this person who works at the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And the person said to me that there's two issues. One, it's so dangerous there, you cannot believe it. And two, that somebody is well training. You may have read about some of this on the blogs, but I hadn't, so... somebody is really training the snipers extremely well,
yeah,
and they are able to shoot through Humvee. No. These are like...
No, I mean, we train these guys, and then they leave the Army, and they go out.
Yeah, but I don't think we're training snipers in that kind of way,
okay,
over there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're wondering where these people are getting their training, so
yeah,
it's not from us.
Yeah.
That they were able to shoot someone through a Humvee... between their flak jacket and where their helmet hit in their head.
Hit that little 2-inch circle.
That 2-inch circle.
Wow.
And that's how well-trained these guys are.
Yeah.
And that, trust me, United States military ain't training them that well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Andy Abramovich, who I didn't know her well. She worked at Air America Radio. I knew her and met her and worked together with her. And she was killed in Iraq just 2 weeks ago.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Who was she embedding with somebody?
She was working with the Republican and Democratic parties have these...
The Republican Institute, that's the Democratic
right.
Institute.
Yeah. And she was there, working, helping to bring democracy to Iraq. And she got killed in an ambush. And she had just finished giving a talk and was driving away.
And she'd worked at Air America?
Yeah, she worked for 2 years, I think, maybe even 3 years, at least 2 years. She was sort of Jamie Horn's assistant. She was just a really neat person. I mean,
So I said, okay to Afghanistan, but I'm not sending more of my people to Iraq.
Yeah.
It's just too dangerous. What did Congressman McDermott say? Was it McDermott who
said that? Yeah, it was Jim McDermott. He said that the situation is going... Well, I don't want to put words in his mouth. My recollection of what he said was that the situation is going to hell in a handbasket and that we are the major irritant.
Of course. And once we pull out of there, let them do their thing or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not going to be pretty, but it probably isn't going to be as bad as 60, 70... 70 Iraqis being killed a day.
Right. No, it'll resolve fairly quickly. Somebody is going to seize power. And,
right.
And the danger is probably the wrong word. The problem is that in all probability it's going to be the Shia, and they're going to instantly align themselves with Iran, which is going to infuriate Saudi Arabia, flip out Jordan. Syria will join the Axis, and you're going to have basically a regional Cold War, and it could turn into a hot war. And that then could lead and then Saudi Arabia is talking about, well, then we'll flood the market with oil to drive the price of oil down to $10 a barrel to cut off the funding for the Iranians. And the
right.
Iranians are looking at that going, well, maybe we'll blow up a few Saudi oil fields and drive the price of oil up to $200 a barrel so that we make a whole lot of money.
No, I mean...
And this is a mess.
This is a regional war, and
George Bush
could become even bigger.
George Bush opened the gates of hell.
Yes.
I mean, I just don't know how to say it better than that. The first time I heard it, Randy Rhodes said it.
You're just a few blocks
from
him.
So, yeah, at this moment. Yeah, here we are in the belly of the beast, and he
You really are in the belly of the beast today.
Yeah. Yeah, in the Mayflower Hotel. You know, Franklin Roosevelt gave a speech in this hotel.
Wow.
Yeah, back in 1947.
My last question to you. I know your book party, I wish it would have been bigger, but we did it in the hotel. And
we had a great
maybe
time
that was
last
a
night.
Mistake to not have more and more people, but I'll do another one for you.
No,
I'd like to do one maybe in New York or something.
It was wall-to-wall
but
people.
I hear you're working on another book.
Yes, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. It'll be out next fall. This fall.
Well, we're going to do a big one for you.
Yeah, yeah. We're
we'll do it either here or New York, or we'll do something cool.
Indeed. So,
anyway, I like giving book parties, for you especially.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com. Doing well?
Very well, yeah. I mean, we're going to open up in New York, too. We're opening an office.
Really?
Hopefully covering the United Nations, yeah.
Oh, that's marvelous.
Full studio there, so...
That's marvelous.
Podcasting with VCasting. Eventually, come and get your mug on television.
Oh, that's great. A lot of cool stuff going on. That's absolutely marvelous. Well, we're going to, as soon as we wrap up this segment here, which we're going to do right now, we'll come back and take your phone calls on pretty much any topic you want. We'll just wrap up the hour here talking to folks on the telephone. 1-866-440-8466, our phone number. Tom Hartman here with you. This is the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
Did you interview her?
Listen to the radio. See it on the TV. Headlines in the morning paper. The clock of history repeats.
And tragically, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Johnson just walked over and sat down. I am so pleased to see you. Larry Johnson, former CIA officer, former State Department official, former counterterrorism official. Now you run you do a blog over at noquarter.typepad.com.
Do a blog, and I also do security consulting still with the U.S. military.
Yeah, that's great. I have done training for the CIA and for U.S. military intelligence, and I've done consulting for the NSA, and they pay very well. That was years and years ago, back when I was in the advertising business. But you were out there doing the spook work, the the real stuff.
It sounds sexier than it really is.
Yeah, so I understand from the folks I know who do it. Got a couple of callers here who I think may have issues. Actually, one seems to have dropped off. There was a caller on the line who was raising the issue, which frankly is I think Ross Story is dealing with today. Apparently, maybe not. This is about four soldiers who did not, the government basically lying to us about what's going on in Iraq. What's your take on what's going on in Iraq right now, Larry?
What I'm seeing right now is a shift in. Up till about 2 months ago, I think the military was pretty straightforward through military channels, reporting what was going on, reporting the number of the attacks, indicating that the situation was actually deteriorating. Now it appears that the politicization, if you will, of the intelligence on the military side is taking place, that they're starting to pull punches. I just heard today, for example, CNN reported as I was driving in that the story that was released last Saturday that five U.S. soldiers had been killed in Kabul. Turns out that actually four of them have been taken prisoner and hauled off from the site.
Yeah, that's apparently the story. Contrary to U.S. military statements, four U.S. soldiers did not die repelling a sneak attack at the governor's office in Karbala. New information obtained by the Associated Press says they were abducted and found dead or dying as far as 25 miles away.
Yeah, so if that's true, it just further illustrates this tendency now to, try to, if you will, try to put lipstick on a pig.
Yeah,
they want to make it appear to be better than what it really is, and the situation on the ground there is dire.
Yeah, and your thoughts on Bush's surge?
Oh, it's meaningless. Other than when you put more troops into Baghdad, and they're going to put these guys out, let's call them miniature Fort Apaches.
Right.
You're going to increase the likelihood that either they're going to be overrun by insurgents, and so you'll have a higher incident of U.S. casualties. Or these folks in their operations are going to go out into the neighborhoods and they're going to be kicking in doors and they're going to be shooting the places up. And what happens with the insurgents, they melt away.
Right.
And so what it leaves the United
States... Well, they're just the locals. They're the guys who
right.
were the garage mechanic 5 years ago and will be again 5 years from now after we're gone.
Exactly. And so what happens is it makes it more difficult to win hearts and minds of the people. You end up pissing more people off.
Yeah.
And in the process, that doesn't make the U.S. position there stronger.
Right. You kill somebody's son, you kill their nephew, you kill their whatever...
Well, you've got such a major disconnect in the policy here because, on the one hand, we're really fortifying and strengthening a Shia-led government in Iraq. But we are in the process of preparing to go to war with Iran.
A Shia government.
A Shia government.
Right.
And who is the Shia government in Iraq right now is receiving significant support from Iran. But they're doing it behind the scenes. And so somehow...
And now Bush has announced that any Iranians found in Iraq, he's going to shoot.
Yeah.
At the same time...
Capture.
Yeah. At the same time that my understanding is that one of the things that came out of that meeting were, I believe it was Maliki, it might have been the president rather than the prime minister, of Iraq, went to Iran back, 3 months ago? Thereabouts.
Right.
First
of November.
Yeah, they signed this mutual non-aggression treaty and a cooperative. If somebody attacks us, it's like they attacked you, whatever you call those pacts. And that Iran was going to be sending people into Iraq to help out.
Right.
And so are we going to be shooting at people that the government of Iraq has invited in?
Yes. I mean, that's...
Honest to God,
that's really the bottom line. The danger here for the United States... is with increased flow of troops into Baghdad, the supply line to keep them in everything from, food, water, beans, bullets, that runs on the ground from Kuwait up to Baghdad along the road. Remember Jessica Lynch at the start of the war and her transportation column that was ambushed.
Right.
What we do is we put our soldiers at risk because the Shia can rise up and choke off that resupply line.
Right. Not a good thing. Not a healthy thing at all.
It make sense militarily.
Yeah. And so most of the governments in the region are the Sunnis, that from Saudi Arabia to Jordan, that whole Sunni crescent that we are aligned with. And now you've got the Shia up north. The Sunnis represent most of the
right.
Muslims in the world. But the Shia up north, the Syrians and the Iranians, and now a majority in Iraq. I just don't see any way out of this thing other than just...
Get out.
We get out. Iraq forms a Shiite alliance with Iran ultimately, and if we can stay out of the way, maybe they can live in peace. I don't know.
We have to figure out what we want to do, and we haven't done that yet.
Yeah, well, that's a big
question. Are we going to be with the Shia or are we going to be with the Sunni? And right now it appears we want to fight both.
Or are we going to ignore them both and simply say, we'll buy your oil? You know, just let dollars talk and just say, we'll buy your oil.
Right.
We're not going to play military
that's
games.
That's another
we're
alternative.
We're not going to play Lawrence of Arabia anymore.
But we're not choosing that road.
Yeah, which crazy. Larry Johnson, noquarter.typepad.com, the blog. Check it out. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Great having you on. 20 past the hour. We'll be right back. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Harbin here with you. The pill that will help you escape the Matrix. You going to take the blue pill, the green pill, the red pill? How about the Tom Harbin program pill? 34 minutes past the hour. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Thanks for waiting so long, Karen. What's up?
I'm just Chuck Hagel, Nebraska, and GQ. Have you had a chance to read that article yet?
I have not. I've read excerpts from it, but I have not yet had an opportunity to sit down and read the article itself.
Yeah, well, Bush wanted...
this is the one where Chuck Hagel said that the Bushies were basically telling Congress how to behave.
Yeah, well, Bush wanted a resolution saying he could invade anywhere in the Middle East.
Oh, right, yeah, that's right. And and Hagel himself, he said, he claims that he himself actually rewrote that thing to make it specific to Iraq.
He and Biden and the other chap. Who
right.
Was, so, and when I, you know, that was really scary to see. That's what his original intent was. So,
yes.
So, at any rate, that's all I wanted to bring up is Bush's grandiose plans in the Middle East.
Indeed. Well, you did, Karen. Thank you very much, and I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Brian in Laguna Beach, California. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Tom. Always a pleasure to chat with you. I say listen on the Internet, so today I added a little shortcut icon for you. I wanted a little light bulb because you're my idea man, but they didn't have one, so I put a cup of what I've decided is Sacred Grounds coffee, steaming coffee. That's your icon to give a little
Thank
plug
you.
To our sponsors.
There you go.
I was curious, Tom, you've spoken many times and you've made a very strong case on the fact that contrary to what popular belief is, the majority of the country is actually progressive. They hold progressive beliefs, although they don't necessarily identify themselves as, you know, liberals or progressives.
That's right.
And politicians like Bernie Sanders, who run very, you know, openly and, you know, without shame on these progressive platforms, tend to get elected by these very strong margins.
Yeah, and John Tester, and, I mean, there's a bunch of them, Governor Brian Schweitzer in Montana and a red state.
The big surprise wins in the congressional, in the midterm elections, I called a few of them up, and I said, I noticed that you weren't really on the radar. You weren't really supposed to win. Are you guys like a real grassroots progressive type movement? And they all said, oh, yeah, it's grassroots. Everybody just flocked to the progressive candidate.
Yep.
And what I'm wondering is I think we obviously need to get that message out there to current politicians and potential politicians. Like, hey, guys, you know, don't if you don't want to do it, you know, for us, you know, that's okay. Do it for yourself. Do it because it's a great way to get elected and get popular. But, you know, knock, knock, this is what really works. And this is effective. And I'm wondering what your evaluation is of the attempt to communicate that to politicians and potential politicians. I mean,
is
Bernie working on that?
The problem is the mainstream media. And yes, actually, Bernie is working on that. He's you know, looking at and talking about, you know, things like let's go back to some of the rules that we had in the past with regard to the media, about media ownership and media concentration, and particularly in individual markets, in individual
really
cities.
Important.
And because the mainstream media very much is not where most of America is at.
Right.
And you get, you know, these talking heads on these national shows and some of the cable shows and the network shows and whatnot. And obviously this huge swamp of right-wing talk radio, you know, where they yell at, you know, you lefties, you know, that kind of stuff. So the mainstream media is the problem, frankly.
But we don't really need the mainstream media to echo the voices of the candidate. It works.
We don't.
The way it is right now. Progressive candidates win.
It's
in
working.
Montana just now.
No, I agree. It's Brent, but it's working because of the internet. And what? And so what are they trying to do? Gordon Smith, Senator Gordon Smith, Republican from my state, from Oregon, is out there trying to destroy net neutrality. Exactly.
Yeah, I hope that doesn't happen.
You know, as soon as a media pops up that has some that talks back to these guys, they're like, oh, no, we can't have this. We can't have this. We've got a, you know, liberal talk radio. The Internet. And they're going to try and control it. And that's why when Bernie says it's not enough just to vote, he is so right. We all have to be getting out there and having our voices heard and being active, being activists. Brian, I got to move along. I got a bunch of other callers, but I appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. Gary in Portland. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Oh, Tom, you drive me crazy every time you start going on about how wonderful Truman and Roosevelt were. I don't know where you're getting your history. I'd like to suggest a book. It was called Labor's Giant Step by Art Price, P-R-E-I-S, Labor's Giant Step. And in there he talks about, I talked to you about 20 seconds last week about Frances Perkins, who was Roosevelt's Secretary of Labor.
Yep.
And in her book she said that Roosevelt had nothing to do with the Wagner Act and that when he was informed of it, he didn't like what he was hearing.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that, and I told you I have the book and I'm going to look at it. I haven't yet. But the fact of the matter is that whatever that the case may have been when he was first informed of it, Roosevelt was a champion of the Wagner Act. The Wagner Act was passed. He signed it. He appointed people to the National Labor Relations Board as a consequence of it, and he became a strong. He may not have started out that way, but I pointed out on this program before. Roosevelt ran on a very moderate platform in 1932. Just like Teddy Roosevelt, you know, as vice president, was running I'm a rich white guy platform, you know, kind of thing. And the fact of the matter is that the parade caught up with him, and he said, hey, wait a minute, this is the way America's going. This is what's going to work. And so just because a politician at one particular moment in time is taking position A, and later they take position B, and I'm going to congratulate them for taking position B, doesn't mean that I shouldn't congratulate them for taking position B because at one point they held position A. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And Harry Truman, I mean, you know, when the Republicans took, you know, the Republicans won the House and the Senate in the election of 1946. And Harry Truman now is confronted with a Republican House and a Republican Senate. And they passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which waters down the Wagner Act. Harry Truman vetoed it.
Yeah, he vetoed it.
And they overrode his veto.
I think it was more for political reasons than anything else.
Well, that's what it should be. You want your politicians to be doing what the people want done.
Well, I don't think he was doing it for the people. I think if you really want to figure out what make a correlation between the rise of the middle class and a phenomena, it's the union movement. And
I agree. I agree. You have heard me say that. Well, I don't know how many, you know, I was going to say you heard me say that 100 times. I don't know how many times you've heard me say it, Gary, but I talk about that constantly. That is the main bulwark of the middle class. That is having equal power in the workplace between labor and management. Absolutely.
I mean, Roosevelt was basically trying to prevent a revolution in the United States.
Yes. Roosevelt, not so much a revolution. He was trying to prevent the country from flipping hard to one extreme or the other. Keep in mind, in 1932, it was the coming into the depths of the Great Depression. People were freaked out. It was absolutely politically acceptable to be a fascist because fascism was just starting to rise in Europe, and Mussolini and Franco, and people were saying, hey, that looks pretty good. They're getting their countries under control. Even Hitler was you know, very, very, very popular in Germany. He was Times Man of the Year in, what, 33 or 34 on the cover of the magazine. On the right, Roosevelt had that. On the left, he had the communists and the old Marxist socialists. And you had these two warring factions, both out in public. I mean, both, you know, speaking candidly. And Roosevelt was like, no, we're gonna go a middle way. We're gonna go down the road, down the middle, and maintain capitalism. We're not gonna swing all the way to the left, but we're gonna regulate capitalism. We're not gonna swing all the way to the right either. And he successfully did that. And you know, he may have had some concerns about the labor movement at some point, but he aggressively embraced it in his later years, and God bless him for it. Gary, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Linda in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Linda.
Hi there. Hey, yeah, I want to tell everybody there's a big march in Seattle tomorrow at 23rd and Union, And it starts at 12:30, not 2:30. You guys have got it listed on the events page as 2:30.
Okay, you guys meaning KPTK?
Yeah, I just sent another email so you guys can correct it. But,
okay, if anybody at Talk 1090 is listening, change your events page to say 12:30 instead of 2:30 for the big march tomorrow.
Because everybody else missed it if they get there at 2:30.
Yeah, well, it's probably just a typo.
You can check with World Can't Wait, but I'm pretty sure that's what it said. I looked at it twice in the last couple of days. So anyway, everybody come on out.
Great, yeah, and have a good time. And I'll be doing the same thing here in Washington, D.C.
Great.
Linda, thank you very much for the heads up on that.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Bye now. Ruth in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ruth.
Hey, Tom, I understand you already discussed Cheney being on Wolf Blitzer's the other night, and he said that we were very successful in Iraq.
Oh, it's just tremendously successful. They just love us there. It's
unbelievable.
No shame
in lying to the American people. And another thing I wanted to ask you, Tom, do you know, like, when we get the death count of the soldiers in Iraq, that those are the actual soldiers that died in Iraq, but when they're shipped to Germany or whatever for medical attention, if they die in Germany, that is not counted into the death count? Do you know that?
My understanding is that if they die in Germany or if they die in transit or if they die soon thereafter, after leaving Iraq, that it's still considered an Iraqi casualty. On the other hand, and I've asked a couple of politicians about this, a couple of folks who would, Larry Scott or VAWatchdog.org would be in a position to know. But the other question is, if somebody comes back, and a year later they die of something that doesn't seem to be combat related, but really might be. It might be, they die of kidney disease, but it was actually depleted uranium poisoning.
Right.
How is that counted?
Yeah.
It's almost, Ruth, there's almost a certain level of splitting hairs here. It almost doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is nobody should be dying
in
Iraq.
Right.
And nobody should be exposed to depleted uranium, and none of these kids should be getting post-traumatic stress disorder, and 600,000 Iraqis should not be dead, and we shouldn't be bombing their cities.
Exactly.
Ruth, thank you for the call. Let's keep our eyes on the prize. That's the big issue, is that we are raining death and destruction down on a country that we have no right to do it to. 45 minutes past the hour.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, special thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Andrew Dunn, Alex Goldmark, Lauren Kirchner at Air America Radio in New York, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and especially to you for listening to our program. You make it possible. And what a wonderful world it is today. It really is. Extraordinary news. It's just two quick stories here, and then back to the phones. President Bush, this is from The Guardian. President Bush's administration was today preparing for damaging repercussions from testimony by one of its own officials in the perjury trial of Louis Scooter Libby, the former U.S. Chief of Staff to the U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney. Kathy Martin, Mr. Cheney's former spokeswoman, yesterday told a court that she clearly remembered telling Mr. Libby the identity of a CIA operative, Valerie Plame, whose husband, Joe Wilson, had attacked the Bush administration's case for war against Iraq. A staunch Republican, Ms. Martin was recruited to work for Mr. Cheney by Mary Matlin, a close friend of Mr. Libby and Mr. Cheney. Ms. Martin is married to Kevin Martin, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, and is currently the Deputy Director of Communications for Policy and Planning for Mr. Bush. Her account of events backed up the prosecution's case that Mr. Libby found out Ms. Plame's identity from administration officials rather than reporters, as he told investigators. Boy, it's a small world, And in the meantime, this is from Reuters. The U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 was, quote, an idiot decision, end quote. Now, who said this? Adel Abdul Mahdi, Who the heck is that? He's the vice president of Iraq. It was an idiot decision. He says Iraq was put under occupation, which was an idiot decision. This is at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Mahdi said the Iraqi government planned to bring troops into Baghdad from surrounding areas and said it was a technical question for the United States to decide whether to deploy more soldiers. He said, if we can win this war in Baghdad, then I think we can change the course of events. As Iraqis, I think we need more Iraqi troops in Baghdad. We're calling for some regiments to come in from other parts of the country. But bottom line, idiot decision. And history was made, at least the history of the last 6 years, the history of the ongoing coup d'etat, for all practical purposes, the Bushies. History was made, the crack, 10:15 on Wednesday of this week. Note that date. The first official meeting of the House Judiciary Committee on Oversight, holding a hearing. John Conyers put this thing together. God bless him. Holding a hearing titled, this is the official title of the hearing, Presidential Signing Statements Under the Bush Administration, A Threat to Checks and Balances and the Rule of Law? Question mark. Yeah, I would say so. I would say so in a hurry. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ, what's up?
Hi, Tom. On the minimum wage bill that's being discussed in the Senate,
yes,
John Thune and David Vitter have put on a poison pill amendment that would allow the federal government to create these association health plans. I've had those. They're bad news. They screwed me like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, so tell me, what is, you know, I don't know what an association health plan is. I'm sorry.
You know, with me, what it was is if you belonged to a group of people, if you were in one profession, if you were self-employed, then you could supposedly buy into this health plan. The problem with it is they have outrageous co-pays. They can raise your rates for at any time for any reason, and they can deny your claim, and you can't appeal it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, this is the way they like it. I mean, this is the basic plan. Yeah, I understand what you're talking about now, and they're gonna try and poison pill this thing to death. I thought it was interesting when Bernie was here today. He says we're getting this raise in the minimum wage, and I said, but the Republicans right now are trying to poison pill the thing, and he said they're not gonna succeed.
Heads up for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. So, the bottom line: get out there, get politically active, and let your legislators know that you're not up for this. KJ, thanks a lot for the call.
Sure.
Yeah, for sure. And Glenn Beck criticizes Glenn Beck. Oh, geez. Let's not go there. Steny Hoyer says this from, what's the source of this thing? Where did it go? This is CNN. CNN News is reporting. Democrats may push a new bill authorizing the use of force in Iraq, replacing the 2002 bill that allowed the Bush administration to proceed with the war, says Steny Hoyer. This is a quote from Steny Hoyer. The House will soon address ways to affect the policy and strategy being pursued in Iraq, possibly including a revised authorization for the use of military force in Iraq that more accurately reflects the mission of our troops on the ground. You know, if you go back to the original authorization, I don't know why they're not talking about this. The original authorization said that if Bush invaded Iraq, he had to provide in writing a statement to Congress saying that he was doing so because the Iraqi government was in some way, or Saddam Hussein was in some way involved with 9/11. He wrote that letter and submitted it, and it was a flat-out lie. They should be holding him to account for that. That's what they should be holding hearings on. You know, they have hearings. You know, why is it that Bush lied to Congress? That's got to be a high crime and misdemeanor. shouldn't surprise anybody that Bush is lawyering up like crazy. Well, thanks so much for being with us today and throughout this week. We'll see you next Monday. And don't ever forget, my friends, activism and democracy begin with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.